Welcome to Real Estate Investing for Women. On this show, you will learn how to create wealth through real estate the blissful way. That means with very little stress and very little time. We talk about strategies, mindset, heartset, money smarts, resources, and so much more to ensure you're able to create the success you most deeply desire. Now, here's your host, Monica Sawyer.
Hi, ladies. As you know, we have a webinar with Chris Larson this Thursday from 1 to 2:30 p.m. Pacific time. We'll be talking live about the biggest topic you ladies have questions about regarding syndications, how to evaluate a syndication. It's going to be a great conversation, so come and ask all of your questions. We'll stay live as long as you need us to. To sign up, go to blissfulinvestor.com/syndication webinar. Also, what you might not remember is we held a webinar last year with Chris where he did a complete detailed breakdown of a deal he was real-time raising funds for. It was one of the most interesting conversations I've ever had about syndications, which is why I wanted to bring Chris back for another webinar. He is so good at explaining how things work and is patient and thorough in answering questions. So join us on Thursday for our upcoming webinar. Go to blissfulinvestor.com/syndication webinar. And in the meantime, since many of you didn't get to hear the webinar last year, here is a replay of it. Listen to it. You will really learn a lot.
Ladies, before we get into the meat of this episode, let's have a quick word from our sponsor. If your idea of asset protection and tax mitigation is setting up a simple LLC and family trust structure, you could be leaving your business, real estate, and personal assets completely exposed. Imagine instead being able to take advantage of the bulletproof asset protection tools formerly reserved for the ultra wealthy. If you'd like to mitigate or eliminate your capital gains taxes while protecting your assets from predatory litigation, visit blissfulinvestor.com/trusts. That's plural. There, you will find out more in a free recording with the world's foremost expert on a new kind of trust structure you've probably never heard of. This is a true generational wealth building business and personal asset protection and tax mitigation structure dating back to the founding of our country and is still used today. Just go to blissfulinvestor.com/trusts to find out more. It's free.
Okay, Chris, so I know you have a new deal that just went live today. So I want to hear all about
like 12
that.
Hours ago.
Right? Yay! Yeah. So I think that one of the best ways to actually get to learn about these deals is to walk through one. So this is super exciting. So do you want to share that with us?
Absolutely. So let me pull up, I'll share my screen here. And I got a ton of stuff. So if you are new to the syndication space, if you're listening to this, if you're watching, first off, I'd recommend just going to the website, nextlevelincome.com. I wrote a book about why I feel like multifamily real estate is the holy grail of investing. Mm-hmm. And just to be clear, I was an investor before I started syndicating deals. I was buying properties. I know, Monica, you and I talked about this when we were together on the podcast. I managed my own portfolio of real estate for 15 years. Mm-hmm. And then I was working 60, 80, 100-hour weeks. I was on call 12 years out of my career. And it didn't interest me in doing that. But also, I'm an engineer by training. So I was like, I really want to figure out the best way to do things. I'm always looking for a better way to do things. And I was introduced to multifamily. So after having this conversation many, many times, I decided to write a book about it. So you can go to the website, nextlevelincome.com/book. And you can get a free copy of the book here.
Actually, go to nextlevelincome.com/bliss.
Bliss. That's right.
Yeah, yes, we got absolutely. Our own page well. Just for my
that's
ladies.
Right, we do.
And there's a bunch of other things that are on there, actually, ladies. So go to the nextlevelincome.com/bliss.
Absolutely. There you go.
There it is.
And this is exactly what we're going to be talking about this evening here. And we have even more stuff that we've added. So you can always email me. We added 5 ways you can set your kids up for a lifetime of financial success. So these are some tools you can use, five different things: start a bank account, pay your children, teach them about investing, start a business, and teach them about the value and cost of college. So I'm big on the why. And that's really, you know, as we get into tonight, it's like, why do we do this? Why do you invest? You invest for time, you invest for freedom, you invest for the ability to do different things. But I'd like to talk about a little bit more about the deal. So before I get into this, Monica, I want to talk about the process. So if you're new to syndication, how would I look at a deal? Like if you sent me a deal and said, hey, Chris, what do you think about this? And by the way, this happens to me at least once a week. I had one of my fellow mastermind members, and he actually set it up. So he sends me this deal, and it was in this little town in Alabama. And he's like, hey, what do you think about this deal? And as investors, we look at the numbers. We're like, all right, what are the returns going to be on this deal? And I looked at the deal, and my first question to him was, why do you like this town? And his response was, I don't know if I like this town. So I searched this town. It was 18,000 people. 11,000 of those 18,000 people in population were students. Now, if you looked, you'd be like, wow, this town's growing like crazy. Well, 18,000 people, if you're in a decent sized city or town, that's a small concert in some towns, right?
No kidding.
Can blow that out. So one of the things you need to be conscious of is, why are you investing in a specific area? Like, why multifamily? That's what I talk about in my book. And I'll talk about that here in a minute. But why a certain geography of the country are you going to invest in? So I'm going to walk through a lot of that as I kind of unfold this deal here. But the first thing I'm going to talk about is, why multifamily real estate? Why do I call it the holy grail of real estate? And the reason is, multifamily is very stable. People always need a place to live, and it waxes and wanes. It's hot. It's kind of lukewarm at times, but multifamily real estate, apartments never seem to be cold because people always need a place to live. We have a few trends as well, and I talk about these in my book. One of the big trends, one of the big problems we have this decade, 2020 onward, is that we've not built enough housing. And if you're anywhere in the country right now that's even remotely desirable, you know this, you can't get a house. It's hard to find a place to rent. And we just haven't built enough apartments. We haven't built enough homes. And the question is, like, why would we not do that? Isn't this a capitalistic society? Wouldn't money flow into that area? Well, the problem is we just didn't build at all coming out of the Great Recession. And the banks tightened up lending. My wife and I started building spec homes in 2012, 2013. We called over 30 banks. And there was one in a town of Asheville, North Carolina, which isn't huge. But out of almost three dozen banks, there was only one bank that would lend to us to build a house. And this was in 2012. So in 2013, 5 years after the Great Recession started, you almost couldn't get money to buy a house or to build a house. So if you think about that, we have to make up for that lull. And then you have the millennials. You have 20 million potential households or more living with their parents still. Well, they're all moving out and they're looking for houses. They're looking for places to live. And guess who else is looking for places to live? Their parents, because they're downsizing, they're moving to better areas of the country. So if you find an area of the country that is desirable, there's a housing shortage already. We don't have enough homes. Millennials, baby boomers, and Gen Z, I think 36% was the article I read 2 weeks ago, about a third of Gen Z say they want to own a home. Only a third. 75%, about three quarters of immigrants rent. So you have just all these trends that are really pushing the multifamily market. So that's number one, multifamily market. Number two, what areas of the country do you want to invest in? So I'm going to show you today this deal in Florida. It's probably no surprise. Monica, I know you're in California. I'm sure you don't love the state tax rate, is my guess. I have friends in other areas of California and they don't like the local policies. There's been stories in San Francisco about stores getting looted and these problems. And there are people that say, you know what? I don't want to pay the tax and I don't want to deal with this. And oh, by the way, I'm remote now. I can live wherever I want. So they move to places like Idaho, Colorado, like Oregon, like Texas, like Florida, like the Carolinas. All these states are in the top 10 of the country. And I can dive really deep. I don't want to get too into this in engineering. I can get really nerdy on all this stuff, but I can go through all the statistics of how you look at this. But I think if you listen to those states and most people nod their heads and say, yeah, I'd rather live in an area with a lower cost of living and a better quality of life. Although I do love California.
Yeah, no, I love California too. But you're right. Every place that you live or build or grow a business, there's advantages and disadvantages. right now, I still love being in California, but I know definitely there are things that are not working here. So what I wanted to say is we've never actually had someone go in, do a deep dive on sort of those numbers. Would you mind maybe go a little bit more high level? But I would love to hear some of that.
Absolutely. Let me pull up. Let's see here if I have a couple.
I don't want to like interrupt your presentation, but
you're so good
at what you do. And
I'll tell you what, I can do this probably in a pretty succinct way without getting too crazy here. So the easiest thing to do is look at census data, Monica.
Okay.
And you don't have to go and look through all the US census data, although that's where this comes from. So I was doing a presentation yesterday, as I mentioned, and I showed this slide. These are the fastest growing states in 2021. And I think I just did a search and looked for fastest growing states in the United States. Again, I'm not saying I like or don't like states. This is just data from where people are moving. The darker the states, the more people are moving to these states. And if you look here, you can see on the West Coast that people are moving typically out of California to states like Idaho, Nevada, Utah, and Arizona, Colorado, Texas. I joke around and call Austin the least expensive city in California. And then also the Southeast. So look how dark the Southeast is here. And that's because people are moving out of the Northeast. And this goes down here, talks about the fastest growing states in the United States. This with a little bit with a grain of salt, like Idaho has a population of less than 2 million. If you're going to be buying properties like big apartments or multifamily, you want to be buying in areas that there's a lot of transactions. So we like cities that are typically 250,000 or above, even a million are really nice sized cities because a lot of transactions occur there. So a state like Idaho, maybe that's not a good fit for us. Look at Arizona, for instance, here, over 7 million, Nevada, Utah, Texas, South and North Carolina, I'll show you down here, are in there. Montana is another fairly small state, and Delaware is another one that's fairly small. But if you look down here, you see those states that I just mentioned, North and South Carolina, Florida, Colorado, Washington. Washington state is growing, but there's some issues with some of the cities in Washington that make me shy away from it. Texas, Utah, Arizona, Nevada, and Idaho. So I think all these are great states to look into.
What is it about Washington, for instance?
When you're looking, and you know this, you're a landlord. So when you're looking at states to invest in, you want to be in states that have landlord-friendly laws, also are business-friendly. And I just ran into a neighbor down the road and his business. Now, he lives in Asheville, North Carolina. They're based in Seattle. He's like, oh, I just got back. I was in Seattle for 3 months. I said, oh, what are you doing there? I'm shutting down our office. So why are you shutting down your office in Seattle? He goes, they drove us out of the city. He goes, they don't want businesses there. They didn't force us to leave, but he said, it doesn't make sense for us to do business in Seattle anymore. Amazon is divesting from cities like Seattle as well. So you also have to be considerate of that. And you have to look at what the businesses are doing and what the trends are doing. So when we look at crime, when it comes to neighborhoods, it's okay if crime is within a certain range, but you don't want crime to be rising. So you don't want state taxes to be rising. You don't want businesses to be leaving. So a state that has less businesses, but it has more businesses moving in is better than a state that has more businesses, but businesses moving out and taxes rising, because what you really want is growth in an area. So that's what we're looking for, is growth in an area. And a state like Washington state may be growing, but it's very rural in some different areas. Mm-hmm. So you have to be conscious about that as well.
You want to know that there are more businesses coming in. You want to know that crime isn't going up, that it's maybe stable or going down. Is that the sort of stuff you can find out online also? Or
absolutely. And again, this is like a whole hour
it's
and a half.
It's its own thing. I know.
Yeah. So given it a high level, but if you're an investor, I don't think you have to go and you have to pull all this data.
Okay.
But what I would say is I would be conscious of kind of, you can go and just search like, hey, Chris has shown me this deal in Fort Myers. Let's look up, are businesses growing there? You can just do a search and see that. And I can show you some stats on Fort Myers. And then even more importantly, and I'm going to talk about this when we get into the analysis of a deal at a high level, you ask the operator, the syndicator, the general partner, you say, hey, Chris, tell me about the situation in Florida with businesses, or tell me about what the city is doing to draw in businesses. Tell me about these things. You don't have to have the answers as an investor, but certainly whoever you're investing with, if we're talking about a syndication, that person should have the answers for you, if that makes sense.
It does. Thanks. But I will say this, that my husband is like an engineer like you. And we just had a deal come across our desk and the numbers that were put in the deck were wrong. So he was saying things like, well, these numbers are a little bit misleading. I still like this deal because of this, but they have a lot of business right now, but businesses are going down. That's not stated. But for him, he was able to go do that deep dive and the syndicator was not forthcoming on that stuff. Wow. And maybe they found their numbers a different way, but it basically, we lost our trust in that particular syndicator.
Details are really important in this business because the math, the multipliers are really big in the multifamily space.
Yeah. Anyways. Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah,
I keep asking all these questions, but I'm doing it myself, these are things that are, you know.
Oh, this is another article I had pulled up just talking about the two generations that are clashing. They're both battling over gaining housing in these different markets. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. So I'm going to show you this deal in Fort Myers. You're an investor and you search and you're like, well, why should I be interested in Fort Myers? Number one fastest growing city in the US. This is one of the reasons that we were interested in this market. Now, it's a smaller market. So in a market that's less than 1 million people, I'm going to want to see a lot larger growth rates than a market like Orlando, where we just bought two properties. I don't expect Orlando to grow as fast because it's a much larger market. It's going to take a lot more to move the needle. So I'm going to want to see faster growth rates there. I was just talking about in that deal in an 18,000 person town. I mean, you might see some impressive growth numbers, but 1,000 people one way or the other are going to move that really, really fast. And that's almost too small. So I'm going to get into all those different subjects as we get in here and stop me and we can discuss this. First things first, when you're an investor and you look at a deal, don't get distracted by the pretty pictures. We like pretty pictures. Investors like pretty pictures. It's appealing. Like the property should look nice, but you want to look at the meat of the presentation. You want to look at really what's inside the presentation. That being said, I mentioned details matter. Now, I'm not going to say we've never had a typo in our presentation. We've transposed some numbers and done different things, but you want to make sure that your operator, your syndicator in a deal like this is really buttoned up. And I just said a word, a big word, syndication. If that intimidates you, if you're listening to this, syndication is simply finding a deal. My partners and I go out and find a deal and we partner together with investors and bring those investors together to purchase a deal together as a team is a syndication. It's buying a property as a team. Like on a baseball team, you have management, you have the pitcher, you have the catcher, you have people in the bullpen. Although I heard we can't say bullpen anymore. I think somebody got upset about that during the World Series. I'm not even kidding. But and then you have people that don't even play. You have the staff, you have the assistant coaches and those sorts of things. And syndication is a team sport. I talk about how real estate's a team sport in my book. And that's a great way to think about a syndication. It's a team coming together to buy a deal and everybody has their place. And investors, like the players on the field, are really important, even though they may not be the management staff. So this is a picture of driving into the property here in Fort Myers. Let's talk about some of the high level points here. So we are buying this property in Fort Myers, Florida. And a lot of these numbers, if you haven't seen these before, can be intimidating. Like what's a cap rate? We can talk about that. Expense ratios, occupancy. Actually, this occupancy number is not even correct because when we put this together, it's 67% almost 3 weeks ago. Today, it's about 75%. So we're leasing up very rapidly. Actually, it's 100% leased and it's 75% occupied the day we're recording this here. And the day we take ownership of it, it'll be basically 100% leased. This is a $109 million deal that we're raising $38 million for. And I can talk about the structure. One of the things that is kind of unique about our group, although some other groups have been doing it as well, we have a two-tiered structure. So we have what's called a Class A structure, which is a fixed return. So those Class A investors get a fixed return. They get paid first. So it's a very secure position. It's not guaranteed, but it's very secure. And then the Class B investors, they get the actual cash flow from the property, which is typically less than the Class A investors get from a cash flow perspective. But the Class A investors don't get any upside. The Class B investors get all the upside on the deal. So if you see this here, that's why we have the two-tiered structure there.
And actually, I just want to make a comment on that. So that's the way Chris does it, which is very interesting. And it's also different than the way many other syndicators do it. So a lot of other syndicators that I've looked at, their Class A is the first people they come in, they've only got a few units, this many units at Class A, because they commit sooner. That's often for like the purchase of the property. Like they're just trying to get into the deal. So they'll offer a sweeter deal. They still get some of the upside and stuff like that. But in a situation like what Chris is talking about, he's giving everybody the same opportunity. So you can choose Class A or Class B. It's not a limited time only. So there's benefits to both of those, right?
There are. And it really depends. A lot of people are like, oh yeah, I guess if you're retired, you're on a fixed income. Well, I'm in my early 40s. I have a good friend, a former business partner. We're the same age. We're 2 months apart. And he called me a few months back. He said, hey, Chris, I have $1 million. He sold the business. He said, I have $1 million. My goal is to generate $100,000 a year in passive income. Do you have anything that can help me achieve that? And I said, well, you're looking for a 10% return. I said, we actually have a 9% fixed return. I've flipped the page here to show this. If you look down here, the Class A partnership structure, and it varies. Sometimes we raise 10%, sometimes we raise 30% in the Class A structure. It varies based upon the structure of the deal. And it does two things. It provides that opportunity for investors, because we had investors that wanted a higher cash flow, like my friend. And then it also lowers the leverage on the property. So we're not having to borrow as much, because it almost acts like a second loan in effect. Our loan to value ratio goes down, which actually makes it more secure for all investors. And then also, if you're a Class B investor, it actually raises your overall return, because the Class A investors, while they're getting higher cash flow, they're not taking the equity on the back end. Maybe in this deal, maybe you're starting out at a 5 or 6% return in the first year or so if you're a Class B investor, and it goes up, as you can see here in the middle of the second page here, goes up in year two. These are all pro forma projections. But on the back end, your returns are higher. So we're able to provide something for investors that want a higher cash flow upfront that maybe aren't as concerned with growth. And then we're also able to provide higher growth for those investors, even though we're in an asset class that has had returns that are shrinking to a degree. So it's been a way that we've been able to provide something to investors on both ends of the spectrum when it comes to that. So again, these are projections. This is what we like to gravitate towards as investors. I would say flip through all this. And the first thing you want to look at are the details of the property itself. So you want to say, okay, how many units does the property have? What's the current occupancy? What's the rent per square footage? When was it built? Then you can really start to get an idea of what the general partners, what the operator is going to do. I'm going to kind of go out of order here. So why Fort Myers? I mentioned earlier, we want to be invested in areas of the country that are growing. Look at these numbers here on page 20. Fort Myers and the county it's in, 300,000 workers, 17% job growth since 2014. So I like to see in a small city, I say small city, like 250,000 roundabout like that. I like to see 2% per year job growth. So if you look at 2014, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, we're looking in 7 years. I'd like to see about a 14% job growth. That's way higher than the national average, by the way. So seeing 17%, which is even higher, that's 20% higher than 14. That's a significant difference. I had a friend, he's like, there's not a lot of businesses in Fort Myers, are there? 33,589 total businesses. Now, are they all huge businesses? No, you probably have a lot of small businesses there. 55% population growth in the past decade, and it's projected to grow almost another 50% as well in the coming years. Got the title fastest growing city in America. We know Florida's growing about 15%. If you look at the population growth since 2010, look at Fort Myers, just incredible. We just bought two properties in Orlando. Orlando is one of the top five markets in the country. And Fort Myers, I mean, it's totally different. But again, this is what you're going to see between a smaller market and a larger market. So then your next question as an investor would be, well, Chris, why are you guys buying in a smaller market? There's been a lot of money flooding into core markets over the past 10 years. So these are big markets like Austin, New York, San Francisco, Atlanta, a lot of these big markets, Miami, around the country. And then what we've seen over the past 5 years, a lot of money has been flowing into the secondary markets. So that's what we focused on the past 5 to 10 years, were markets like Atlanta, Georgia, Raleigh, Charlotte, Greenville, and Charleston, South Carolina, and then Orlando. Well, now as these secondary markets have gotten more and more investors and money flooding into them, and again, a lot of international money is coming overseas as well, now we've started to look at opportunities in the tertiary markets, And if you think about it, we're not doing this just because we're just running around and seeing what's going on. This is where the population is flowing. People are moving out of city centers, moving to the suburbs. And now they're saying, well, hey, I don't even have to live in the suburbs. I can live somewhere that's even nicer, smaller, better quality of life, less traffic, less taxes. We're following the population where they're moving. That's what we're doing. Does that make sense?
It does. Thank you for that. And you mentioned something at the last slide where you said you're in an asset class that's shrinking a little bit. Could you explain that?
Yeah. So, and I just kind of touched on that. So the more money that flows into an asset class, it does a couple things. It provides a great opportunity for operators like us that are selling deals. We've had some just tremendous exits here this year in terms of returns, but there's more money chasing these deals. Mm. So that means as demand goes up, what's happened is the returns go down. So if you wanted 20% returns 10 years ago, 5 years ago, maybe you were okay with 18% returns. And then a couple of years ago, 15% returns. And now people, I've seen deals with 10% returns. Mm. And you have a lot of people that don't have anywhere else to put all this cash that they have, all this liquidity. Mm. And you have a lot of big players overseas that are coming. So what we look for is we look for deals that need a little bit more work because we're okay. We have a team built to put in the work. I'm going to walk through our strategy on this deal while we're doing that. But we also look for markets that aren't as exploited yet. So we're looking at kind of like the next hot market. And I think it's important to point out our group, we are a private group, but we're buying institutional quality assets. So a group like ours, there's not a lot of groups our size that can go and acquire a $100 million deal like this within 2 months. So we've put together a team and a process, and we can vet deals. We can have our team on the ground very quickly. And we know we have the capital to close on a deal like this in a fairly rapid fashion. And then we're prepared to get in there and actually improve the asset. And some might say, like, Chris, this deal was built in the last year. How are you going to improve it? I'm going to get into some of the ways we do that here in a minute.
Yeah, because it does look gorgeous, by the way. I mean, it is beautiful right up front.
Again, and I'll talk about what that leads to in terms of the quality of residents that we have. But real quick, employment drivers. So this is the next thing. After you've said, okay, this is the geography, this is the state, this is the city that I'm interested in investing as an investor, you say, okay, what is driving this? You have a diversity of employers. So let me give you an example. Back 10 years ago, Houston was dominated by oil. Now Houston has a lot more of an employment base. Okay. If we look at the Fort Myers market, what we're going to see is look at these employers here. We have healthcare systems with 10,000 plus employees. We have local as well as state governments here. So we have county, local governments that are employed, are very stable employers. We also have private. So we have public supermarket. We have Walmart. We have Arthrex, which is a medical company that I'm very familiar with. I have a lot of friends that work for them. McDonald's, another city here, U.S. Sugar, Home Depot, Winn-Dixie, Ritz-Carlton. So I look at this list as an investor and I say, I like this because not only do I have a lot of employers on this list, but I have a lot of different types of employers on this list. They're going to draw in different types of individuals from around there. And then you can see the proximity. So when we look at the map, and I think I have a better picture here of the map. Here it is. So if you look at where these employers are, you can see that this property, you have easy access up 75 to all these employers here. You can get around. I've actually worked for a 6 month period down in this area. So it's very easy to get up and down. Also, I don't know if it's actually on this. Yeah, it is. Number two here is Southwest Florida International Airport. It's the fastest growing airport in the country in terms of seats added. So when an airport's growing that fast, it means that there's demand. There's a lot of travel in and out of the airport. So you know that people are traveling to and from that area. So that's another thing you want to look at is the proximity to the employers that you have here. And forgive me for flipping back and forth through all this stuff, but I told you I'd kind of go out of order. So I mentioned you have employers. Look at the average income. Now, you're in California. You're a little spoiled out there, Monica, I got to tell you. But around the country, if you're looking at $50,000 or $60,000 of average income in a property, that's pretty good. We're at $172,000 per unit. That's literally off the charts. This area is a very affluent area. $2.5 million net worth. 88% of the residents in this area have white collar jobs. 80% are college graduates, almost 80%, 79%. And those that are living in the homes in the area locally are making almost $200,000 a year. So these are very, very strong numbers. And it begs the question, like, why rent? Why not buy a home? Homes in this area are $800,000, $900,000 starting out. So 20-some percent of the residents that are here have relocated. And they might not have the savings built up yet. They might not know if this is where they want to live. They might have just started working for a company. They may be retirees. And they don't necessarily have the ability to buy a house in terms of financial means, or there might not be a house available for them to buy. So they want to live in this area. And actually, a portion of this property are actually townhouses. So they're very nice. It gives you a much more residential feel out there. I mentioned a few minutes ago, how do you improve a brand new property? So we have acquired three properties already this year that are what we would call lease up deals. They're new properties. And the pandemic has really driven a couple trends that have benefited some of the choices we made in the past couple of years that have also allowed us to utilize different strategies. So if you listen to some of my interviews at the end of 2019, I said, hey, we need to be careful going into 2020. I really think based on some of the research that we're facing a mid-cycle slowdown. And when you come to this point in the real estate cycle, which typically is 18 or 19 years, that's a whole nother podcast episode that we can talk about, but it goes back to the 1850s. Again, I'm a data guy. I'm a nerd. I love this stuff and I can tell you all about it. The thing is, when you get to this point, you want to have higher quality renters, higher quality residents. That's going to buffer your downside. And what we saw, the properties, my former partner and I, we were buying in Atlanta. Those properties had about a 90% collections rate. Our properties that we bought over the last 2 years in these higher B+, so B+, like built in the 1990 and after, A quality assets built in the last 10 years or so, 98% collections we had last year in 2020.
So collections, you mean they actually pay their rent? Your collecting
actually
rent.
Paid their rent.
Yeah.
So you can be 100% occupied, and when there's an eviction moratorium and people don't pay your rent, you can still only have 90% collections. And we've seen a lot of that. So I think that's a really good indicator of the stability and how robust this asset class is. Now, the challenge is, how do you create value if you have this really nice asset? First off, the new rents. So we almost bought another property just up the road from this property. I was looking through my notes here. You might have noticed here in one of the prior slides, the average rents in this property are about $2,000 a month. That's market rent. They're actually lower than this in this property because they gave away some concessions. But the ones that are renting today are about $2,000 a month. Renewals right up the road in a similar property are increased by $300. So people are coming out and they're increasing rents $300 a month. So we're going to be able to buy this property. And as these leases come up for renewal over the course of the next year, we're going to have this organic rent growth that's coming from the market. We normally underwrite 4% rent growth. Like in a property like this, it's 4%. So being able to get 15% rent growth just from the market forces that are coming in because of the scarcity and the demand for this area is really incredible. The nice thing for us is that if you're selling a property, you can't sell a property based on what it's going to rent for. You can only sell a property for what it's renting for. And then somebody might say, well, Chris, why would the seller sell this property? The seller is one of the nation's top five builders. Their business is to build, lease up, and sell the property as fast as possible. That's their job. I just paid $4,000 to have my condo unit painted yesterday. I needed it painted in 48 hours. I could have probably had it painted for $3,000 this weekend, but I needed it painted in 48 hours. So I was willing to pay that extra money for it because I was going to make a lot more money by getting that renter in a month sooner, because that's what's important to me. What's important to the builder is they get out of the property, they collect their capital, and they can invest it and start their next project. That's how they make money. So sitting in this project for another year and maximizing the rent is going to actually cost them money because they're not able to necessarily build another project.
That's not their business model, right?
It's not their business model.
Right.
That's our business model.
So you just said that you had basically 100% pre-leased, 75% already full, but you're counting on this growth of the new rents. But as you have renters in, you can't increase someone who's already in. You can't increase their rent
correct
at the same level. So usually with these, it takes some circulation, some attrition and people moving around to make that happen. So how are you addressing that?
That's an excellent question. So we've underwritten that. We have the actual rent roll. So we know when all those leases are going to turn over. So we've baked that in. We don't assume that we're going to get that full amount, like that full $300. So we underwrite that and we have a buffer in. And I'll talk about how our estimates are lower than what we typically actually see. So, but that's a great question. So the new leases will start coming due in, I believe it's March. And then that's when we'll start seeing these increases. So it's really going to take us about 18 months. And if you look at the pro forma, you'll see it really starts to happen in year two. And we're starting to see the full realization of these increased leases. We assume it's going to take longer than it probably is in reality. That's step one. Step two, we're adding technology package. So in a property like this, people like to have Nest or Ecobee. I think this is a picture of Ecobee thermostat, same one I have right back there. So if you're renting a place of this caliber, now again, you can see here, we underwrote $1,250 per unit for all 300 units. We have a quote for $800 to do this. So we try to be a lot more conservative when it comes to this. Dish fiber. So something that we've done over the past 2 years in these properties, everyone is accustomed to having internet these days. Most people, I don't know about you, Monica, but we haven't had cable TV in I think 5 years.
Yeah.
I think it was the 2016 election. I was like, I'm done watching the news. Things are crazy. I can't listen to it anymore. And I canceled cable, but we still pay more for internet and we pay more for subscription services. So instead of letting Charter or Spectrum or AT&T or one of these other companies come in and sell internet, we actually bring in a company. We've been working with a company called Gigify. Now we work with Dish Network, which people are familiar with. They have a product called Dish Fiber. They come and they install it. We do a profit split on the back end. And the residents actually get a lower cost for their internet. What we've been doing is we charge a technology fee for that. They get the base amount. They can also choose the mid-tier or the higher tier to do that. They get better economies when it comes to that for them. And then we have this, like this is showing increased cash flow of $136,800 per year. If you do the estimate of what we're collecting per month, it's going to be significantly higher than that. But we don't expect a full adoption rate. We usually estimate about a 50% adoption rate when it comes to that. But we're seeing 60-70+% adoption. And a property like this, it's probably going to be even higher than that, if that makes sense. And then private yards. So if you look here, I don't know if I can blow this up, but a lot of times you get less money for first floor rents. You get more money for the top floor rents. We get more money for first floor rents because we build little private yards. And if you have a kid, you can let your kids play out back without them running away. If you have a dog, you can put your dog out back. Most of the time we use turf instead of grass. And then the dog's not peeing back there like my dog did in our condo several years ago and kill all the grass in the front yard. So we're actually getting a really significant premium. See, now this is showing $100 per month. We're seeing more like $150 per month. So these are all quote unquote value adds. And if you read my book, you're going to say, well, Chris, how on earth do you do a value add strategy in a property finished in 2021? And those are some of the strategies that we use to actually add value to a property that looks brand new. And most people would assume you can't do anything to that property. These are some areas that we've been able to find value.
What's so interesting about this is over the last couple of years, anybody who has been trying to do value add has had all the problems that COVID brought us, like supply chain and lumber going way up and all sorts of materials going way up. And so we've seen a lot of projects still be profitable, but not have the margins that they had originally planned. And so this is a really interesting way to do the value add without having to deal with a lot of those issues specifically, right?
Yeah. And so there's a couple things. When you have an older value add property, there's a few factors that you have to take into consideration. One, if you're investing, say, $5,000 to $10,000 per door, which is typical for a medium value add property, you have to raise that much more capital. So you're raising significantly more capital. You're not going to get the same quality of loan, typically, because the banks are going to require you to hold more in reserves. They know that the property and the residents are less quality. They also know that your turnover is going to be higher. So we can install Dish Fiber and not kick anybody out. We can install a technology package in a day while somebody's at work. We can install a private yard outside their home and they're still living there and paying rent. They don't have to spend a month, 2 months, 3 months with that unit vacant. So we know that. We also know, just asking the person, do they want it? Will they pay for it ahead of time? and doing it that way. The other thing is, with these value add properties, the cap rates are higher. So if you invest a dollar to get $2 out, if you have a six cap, so $1 divided by 6%, is that about, that's 16. I'm trying to remember exactly what that is. So I'll do the math really quick. I think the multiplier is about 16. So a cap rate is simply, if you pay $100 for something, the cap rate would be how much you would get in cash flow. So a six cap on a $100 purchase price would be $6. So a six cap, 6% cap rate would be $6 of cash flow per $100. And it's a 16.7% multiplier. So if you increase the cash flow by a dollar, you get $16 of value, $16.7. That's pretty impressive. At a 4.5 cap, so we're buying this property and we're assuming we could sell it at a 4.5% cap rate, which is a little bit higher than what we're seeing in the market. That's a 22.2% multiplier. It takes us less money, less time to produce. If you're looking at this, we're just assuming, say, 100, 190, that's $200 per resident. At a 22.22% multiplier, that's times 200, times 12 months, by the way, that's $4,444. In this case, we don't have to invest anything for Dish. They pay for that. $3,250. And the first year, we're creating $444 in value in doing that. That value persists in perpetuity. That's blending all those things together. So it's a very easy way to create a very significant return on your money very quickly in these properties. That's kind of some of the high level stuff. We spent a fair amount of time on this. If you're an investor and you're looking at unit mix, you don't need to spend a tremendous amount of time on this. What I will say is you don't want anything that's too crazy. If there's a property, it's all three bedrooms. Is it all townhouses? Like, why is it all three bedrooms? Because three bedrooms, they rent for more, but you're not going to have as much demand for those. If it's all one bedroom, like why all one bedroom? What about people that have, they work from home? What about people that you can have two roommates in there and do that? Is all two bedroom? Maybe that's okay. But we like to see a nice mix of those. You want to see less three bedrooms, more two bedrooms, more one bedrooms. This is a little skewed because this is kind of high for one bedrooms. But if you look, a lot of these one bedrooms also have a den. So there's a difference here with that. So we have one bedrooms, we have 1.5 baths. Some of these one bedrooms, 946 square feet. That's pretty big for a one bedroom apartment when it comes to that. And then there's also several of these three bedrooms that are down here are actually townhomes, as you can see. So there's 24 townhomes that are associated with this. So we have this really nice mix in this property of townhomes all the way down to one bedrooms, including one bedrooms with a den. So you could have a couple where they work out of the house. Like my wife and I, when we rented our first apartment, it was a one bedroom, but it had a loft. So we were very comfortable in that space. So this is a very flexible property that has a lot of diversity when it comes to the different unit mixes, if that makes sense. This is a lot of the details of the property here. This, again, I mentioned it earlier in the property, top five builder in the country, terrific reputation. If you're talking to an operator of the deal, when you're buying a property, you want to say like, hey, are there any structural issues? Does the roof need to be replaced? Was it slapped together? In a new property like this by a builder of this caliber, I mean, these apartments are built like condos. They're phenomenal. And when you see the amenities in this property and you see some of the finishes, they're really, really well done. Stainless, you have really nice quartz countertops, really nice layouts in here. You see here, this two-car garages in some of these units. We also have one-car garages as well and some storage units in here that also adds additional rental revenue that comes in. These are some of the numbers. So when you get into the finances, you want to know, does the financing line up with the hold period? So a property that takes less work, you can hold it for less of a period of time than a property that's going to take a two-year project to complete. So if you're investing in a property and your operator says, okay, we're going to spend 2 years executing our value add strategy, and they only have debt on there that lasts for 3 years, what if something goes wrong at the end of that couple year period? Because it's going to take 2 years. Monica, you mentioned this earlier. You can't just move people out right away. It's going to take a little while before you can start to implement that 2 year value add plan. So you're really about 3 years out before you finish it and you even start to see that revenue. If you're done and have to refinance the property at that point, you may be bumping up against a problem. In those types of projects, we're putting 10-year debt on those properties. A project like this is very different. We have a 3-year loan with 2 1-year extensions. It's variable, but we have an interest rate cap to cap our risk when it comes to interest rate fluctuations. So we typically model our hold periods for 5 years. We've actually sold, all of our exits have been 3 years or less, actually less, fairly significantly less than 3 years. So we're comfortable with a 5-year loan on this type of property. Our interest rate is 3.35% in the underwrite, but we are looking at potentially getting that down to 3%. So very nice property. We also get a really nice quality loan when it comes to that. The other reason we're choosing this is the exit fees on a loan like this are a lot lower. What happens is on some of these agency loans that you get from Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, you end up having to pay a significant exit fee that eats away at your profits on the back end. So as an operator, we have to balance the loan terms, the loan duration, along with the fees that we have to pay on the back end, if that makes sense.
It definitely does.
Yeah.
Thank you for that rundown. The other thing is, I just want to mention to the ladies, because they kind of listen to all of this, and when you're doing financing, so a lot of times what happens is you either have to refinance it or it turns into a regular loan, or they do these rollovers. And right. Every project that I've ever looked at, the rollover seems key to me because there's kind of a rule in real estate. And it looks like you do a great job of keeping to your timelines, your expense lines. But a lot of times they will say, if you have a project and you have a budget and a time frame, double the budget and double the time frame, right?
Double it. Yep.
Exactly.
And that's why, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's why our 5-year projects, we have 10-year debt. This project, when we were like, you know what, this project's going to be stabilized in a couple of years. And if we exit it in 3 years, a 5-year loan is ample for that. So again,
but I like
that's
the rollover opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that's really, as an investor, you want to say, okay, does it match up? And is there a buffer? I've seen some projects with 2-year bridge loans, and I'm not saying those don't work, but if you have 2-year debt on a value add project, it's worked out really well in the past several years for investors, certainly, but there's an additional level of risk when it comes there. Mm-hmm. This slide can take a ton of time. I'm going to point out a couple things, and then we can go into a couple sections. As an investor, you want to look at the comparable rents that are out there. And this actually doesn't have the walk on here. I mentioned that property that's seeing those $300 rent premiums. We can only fit so many rent comps on this slide, but I have a full comp list on here. But if you look at this, I think there's something you want to look at as an investor. So this property finished in 2021. It came online. Average rent per square foot, $1.95. Now, our actual rent per square foot is more like $1.75. And this is not taking into account some concessions. But I would note as an investor, if you look at this, where are we in terms of the market? So some markets like California, you might say this is low. Some markets like the Carolinas, you might say this is high. What you want to note as an investor is where does the property fall in the market and where there's definitely room to move in terms of rents in this market, both in terms of rent per square foot, also in terms of rents per unit. There's only one property here. If you look at average rents per unit are lower than this, but if you look at the average square feet, they're smaller. You want to know that you have room to move in the market. We also talked earlier in the presentation about the tremendous income levels in this property. The rent per income, I believe it's correct, was 27%. So there's plenty of room for residents in this property. And also, there's not a lot of other options to get a lower rent in the market. Now, Monica, you were talking about like, when are you going to see these realized rents? Year one rents right here, we are basing these year one rents over in-place leases that are there right now. This people might be like 63% increase. Well, that's insane. That is coming because if you note here over the past year, this property has been leased up. So there's been a huge loss. That gross potential rent. So this is a lease up deal. It's a little different than a stabilized property. That vacancy loss, it's kind of a fake number because that number is like, what if all these units were rented? Well, it takes a while to rent those up. Also, there's a lot of concessions that were given away. If you notice, we're going to have to burn through some of those concessions going into our first year. but they're going to come off. And that's why these concessions are going to drop pretty substantially here as we go into year two. So really year one, it's kind of, it's not an anomaly, but it's hard to really judge anything. This 17% rent growth in year two, that's where we're looking at, all right, what are the comps in the area? And that's actually revenue growth. That's not total growth. So that 17% is coming from rent growth. And it's also coming from, we talked about all the other income that we were bringing in terms of the technology package, the dog guards. So you can see that the other income is going to be growing to $967,000. So that's not a 17% rent increase that we're looking at. It's burning off a combination, burning off the concessions, other income, and rent increases as well. And we're really only baking in an organic 4% rent increase into those numbers is what we're looking at. And you can see that in years 3, 4, and 5. So some people may look at that and say 17%, that's insane. You can't get a 17% rent growth number, but we think that number is quite realistic based upon the fact that that's coming from three different buckets of income in here. The other thing I would point out, operating expenses, these are our total OPEX budget in our properties that are older than this are usually about 36% with our property management company. So seeing OPEX budgets of 39 and 40% for operating expenses, that's pretty high for us. We have two other properties with the same management company in Orlando that are similar quality. And as you can imagine, the higher the quality of property, the lower the operating expenses. You're going to have lower turnover. You're going to have less issues going back and forth, less maintenance. Also, we use a big regional operator. FCA is the management company that we use. And they know this market well. So we are basing our payroll and our numbers for all this. And you'll notice the payroll here, we're stabilizing this at 398,000. This is a lease up payroll. So it's going to be a little bit different, but we're stabilizing this based upon the Florida market numbers that we've seen in our markets, as well as that FCA is providing us that operates in that market. The other thing of note, if you're buying a property, if you look at, there's a huge jump here in our operating expenses, property taxes. This builder bought a piece of land, right? So they're paying significantly less taxes. We're going to be paying more in taxes on a monthly basis than they're paying on an annual basis. So that's something you want to note as an investor. Like, look at the taxes and make sure that they're adjusted and ask your operator, say, hey, what's the tax situation? And how did you figure that out? So we know what the tax rate is. We're assuming it's going to be 85%, which is the discount rate. 85% of the purchase value going into this market is how we're calculating that. We also have some soft insurance quotes that we're using to get these insurance numbers. That's also another great question. If you're looking at a coastal market or Florida, people are like, well, aren't you worried about hurricanes? We're always worried about natural disasters, but we're not worried to the point where we're not going to invest. We're worried to the point of how are we going to insure ourselves and our investors against those risks, just like in any market that you'll be out there. Again, that's a really high level overview of the pro forma and the numbers there. But the questions, just to recap as investors, you want to ask are, what are the assumptions you're using to get your income growth? If you say, hey, Chris, it's not realistic to see rents grow 10% in year one, I would say, hey, Chris, how did you get that? What are you seeing? If we're seeing 15% rent growth in the market, then 10% is not unreasonable. I just talked to my partner today. He's down in Atlanta at a conference, and he said they did a panel and the rent growth that they all shared on stage were 10 to 20% in the Southeast year over year. Wow. It's incredible. These are not just a very specific market. These are the actual rent growths we're seeing in this market. But again, we're not projecting that out for 5 years or we're assuming that they're going to slow down significantly.
Got it. Awesome.
These are sales comps. And then we get into the pretty pictures again, like we were talking about with, with Fort Myers. And we covered a lot of this. This is why is it such a great place to live? And this goes through a lot of the properties that we've had, some of the closings that we've had. And that's the final question, which is really should be your first question, which is who are you investing with? And does your operator, does your GP, does the partner that you've chosen to place your money with, do they have a track record? I should know this exactly. I think this is my 15th apartment syndication that I've been a GP on. We're limited partners or owners in 20 different properties currently. We invest in every deal that we present to investors. That's another great question. Hey, do you invest in your own deals? Why? Why not? How much? When we profit from a deal, we roll that into the next deal. We believe in this strategy and we like to buy properties that we want to own ourselves. And we really just see this as a way to share these opportunities with other people.
I love that. And there was one other thing you said at the very beginning is that you are able to do projects that are sort of institutional size rather than the smaller ones. Could you talk a little bit about how that works out for you, why it's different for you than for other syndicators, that sort of thing? Just give me some perspective on that.
There's a few different pieces of the puzzle that you need on the front end. So I usually tell, I mentioned I was on the mastermind call yesterday and we had two other syndicators and one had a deal that was falling apart. One had a deal that he's putting together. We had a deal that just came through and we joked because I said, it's like a dance. It's like the middle school or the high school dance. And on one wall, you have investor capital. On the other wall, you have deal flow. And it depends on who is on the floor at the right time. You have to have the right deal at the right time with the right capital coming through. If you have two people come off one wall and one person off the other wall, only two of those people can dance together. Well, I guess you could have three people dance together.
That's where the analogy falls apart. But
yeah, the analogy falls apart a little bit there. It depends which wall they're coming off of, if you ask me. But it's overly simplistic. I just crushed my own analogy. But you have to have the right deal and the capital come together at the right time for a long-term partnership. How about that? Maybe we can agree on that. So you have to have the right mix on the dance floor at the right time. So we have created a deal flow. We have five people on our acquisitions team. We're constantly looking at deals. We've underwritten, my team told me they're going to underwrite 450 deals this year, 450.
Wow.
So yeah, this young team is out there, my main partner, and then we have the team underneath of him. And I mean, they're out there looking at, I mean, that's two deals a day on average that they're underwriting. It's like looking at the matrix. If you look at our spreadsheets, it's just deal after deal after deal. But the good thing is because of the number of deals that they're looking at, like I mentioned, this deal, they knew, they're like, oh, this property up the road that we almost bought is getting rent premiums of $300. By the way, the reason that seller didn't sell, because he decided to hold onto the property and get those rent premiums. So they're so good, that seller decided to hold onto that. That broker that was selling us that deal, because that deal fell apart, brought us this deal. So we get deals because of our knowledge of the markets, our relationships with brokers, and just the frequency that we're in there. And then the big piece is our reputation. So we have 100% track record of closing. We typically close on, for deals the size of, a very short timeline of 2 to 3 months, because we know so much coming in. We don't have to spend a month after we get the deal under contract to run through all this process. This deal was under contract just this past week, and we were able to put the package together. Our team's ready to go, putting everything together. I started reaching out to investors a couple of days ago saying, hey, just a heads up, I had some investors on a wait list. I said, hey, we have a deal coming through. Are you still interested? So I know how much capital and what we can move to get a deal done. So we're always tracking those numbers. And then it comes down to communication. So it's sharing information with investors, being transparent, and then also saying, explain the process. So investors know that our deal, our agreement on our end is we're going to find you this deal. We're going to share the details of this deal. Your part of the bargain as an investor, as part of the team, is that you're going to get 2 to 4 weeks to look at the deal and fund the deal. And then we're going to close about a month after that. And our last deal, it was oversubscribed. There are investors that didn't fund on time and they didn't get into the deal. So that's why we had a wait list. And then the big part on our end is I'm sending out investor updates every month. Our investors get distributions every month. They get quarterly updates as far as financials that come in there. And we try to be as transparent as possible when it comes to that. So we have the deal flow, we have the investor relations and the capital side of things. And then on the back end, we've had 4 exits with the team this year. They've all exceeded our pro forma expectations by a significant margin. Our average returns are well into the 20s or higher than that. And you can see our projected returns here. I certainly don't promise those returns on every deal we do. I would look at every deal on a deal by deal basis. But the bottom line is the third piece of the puzzle, or the third leg of the stool, if you will, is the operations side. And our head asset manager, Brian, he ran a portfolio of $1.5 billion, significantly more units than we have now. I think it's a factor of 3. So he's used to running, this is kind of cute for him to run the number of doors that we have at this point. But you need somebody that's comfortable. And that's the other thing you need to ask the operators that you work with. hey, what's your track record? What's your plan? Can you handle this? Like, we're only going to buy 1.6 or 7% of the deals we underwrite this year. It seems like people are like, oh, you bought 7 or 8 deals. That seems like a lot. But when you have a team built to handle a portfolio 3 times your size, we're very comfortable with that. So we're built to scale and we're built to grow. We've built a team to grow into.
Got it. Have you ever had a deal that kind of went south?
So yes and no. So personally, I've not had a deal that I've been a general partner in that has not performed to expectations. That being said, like if you asked me in the middle of COVID, like, are your deals performing like to pro forma? The answer was no. Mm-hmm. So if you look at them overall, I didn't have any investors. I actually increased my investor updates to every week last year because we wanted to tell investors, hey, here's what's going on. And that's our pledge. We want to be as transparent as possible. So yeah, a lot of deals were going south last year, but they were really bobbing. They were bobbing up and down and all of our deals stayed afloat. So this is a great question to ask. Like, what's the worst case scenario? It was actually one of the first deals I invested in. And it was the group that my original partner and I originally partnered with on our first deal. They bought a deal in Houston. I mentioned that Houston was one of those markets that had a lot of oil industry and they didn't have a lot of diversity. This was 7 years ago. Oil was $127 a barrel. And it crashed, I think it was $50 a barrel, if I recall correctly. Oil market tanked. The group I invested with, they had a third partner. There's two of them, a third partner. They split. That third partner went a separate way. They were distracted. They switched to management company. So things were kind of not great just in general with the group. They weren't great in general with the economic market. The management team got switched out at a local level. It wasn't great. And then the hurricane comes through Houston and blows the roof off of, I think it was about 20 units out of 200 units. Oh my goodness. It was just like this perfect storm of events. Now, that deal still made money. I averaged about 5% returns on that deal. I didn't lose capital, but we had a capital call because they had made a big distribution early in the hold period. So I had to send a check in. I'm like, this isn't fun. I'm supposed to be making money from this deal. But I think this is a really important thing to ask the operators that you work with. And also, it's a good example of one of these deals. Really stable, high-quality multifamily deals, they shouldn't lose money. They might not perform to expectations, but if you don't sell in a fire sale, they shouldn't lose money. And that should be your first question, like, am I going to get my capital back? And how am I going to get my capital back? If you listen to everything I said today, and you shook your head and you said, I don't think that's true. I don't think the interest rates are going to be that. I don't think the rents are going to be that. I don't think your numbers are correct. Okay. And then the next question is, well, do you still want to invest? And if you said, well, yeah, I don't agree with you, but I still want to invest in this space. That's why we have the Class A, because you can decrease your risk and you can say, hey, I don't think I'm going to get this return. So I'm going to take a slightly lower return that's more secure and get more of a bond-like return that's 9% on a monthly basis, was at 0.75%, and take that. So I'm not going to argue with an investor that says, hey, I don't really like where the multifamily market's going, but I want to be invested. We have an option for that type of investor as well.
Got it. I love that. Thank you. But it wasn't one of your personal syndications that did this kind of going south thing, the Houston story.
Not technically, but they're friends of mine and they were partners in another deal on ours. And again, I have to temper all this with, if you look at the past 10 years, it's been a really fairly easy time to be in multifamily. You've had cap rates compressing. And if I sit here and I just flashed up all of our deals and how great they did, that's not really worth anything. It is, the track record is important comparatively. And if anybody, if you're listening to this, I can show you all of our current distributions to date, as well as all of our dispositions. So you can see our track record in real time. We update that on a quarterly basis. That's important, but the past isn't necessarily predictive of the future when it comes to the actual number. So if someone tells you, you're going to get a 20% return on this, just run away. If somebody says, hey, this is our best guess, this is what we're striving to do. We strive to get 7% cash and mid-teens return, but these are the things that could change that. It might be a little bit worse, might be a little bit better, but this is our plan to do it. You need to be confident in the plan. If you're confident in the plan, and their numbers make sense, then to me, that's an operator you can rely on. If they have a consistent plan that they've executed, like everything that I walked through tonight, we've done those yards, the first floor, the private yards. We've done the internet service provider. We've done the technology package. We've hired the property management staff in the area. We know what that's going to be. We know what the numbers are going to be. We know we can execute that plan. we can't control the economic environments. We can't control the cap rates. We can't control interest rates and all that stuff, but we can control the plan that we have. And we're very confident of that.
Nice. I love that. And then what is the minimum investment into one of your projects?
Yeah. So our minimum, it's $50,000, which is on this page. We typically have $100,000 minimum for the Class A investors because it's a lot smaller equity slice. So it's in higher demand, but $50,000 is our minimum.
Perfect. That's great. Yeah. Wow. That was a lot of information. And
that was a lot. I ran out of water.
We're like, oh, we'll just do this in a half hour. And here we are 90 minutes later.
So, what time is it? Wow. It has been 90 minutes. That's amazing.
Yeah, that was fascinating.
Asked good questions. So I like couldn't just like, oh yeah, that's that. And we'll flip to that. So let's see here. I should leave with my contact information. Of course.
I don't know if anybody who's online with us has any questions. Please let us know.
I'll pop on here. So this is, so you can see we have a terrific team. This is my contact information here. These are my three main partners that live here right down the road. This is our terrific staff. They do a tremendous job here. But yeah, if you have any questions, feel free, Tracy, I know you're joining us here. Feel free to throw any questions in the chat box or if you want to come on here live and talk, that's great too.
Yeah. Tracy just came off of something that she was actually, I think, hosting. So I'm sure her brain's a little bit fried, but she says, no questions. Okay, good. And Tracy and anybody else who's listening to this, I will be sending this out. And just remember that a lot of talking about a deal, why I wanted Chris to really go deep into a deal is part of the learning curve is to actually do something real and live. Like it's really easy to talk about what syndication is theoretically. It's not easy, but I mean, that's a lot of what we hear. But to actually go deep, and Chris, thank you so much for giving us an hour and a half of your time.
Oh, you're very welcome. Yeah.
When you go deep into the evaluation of a particular property and that you get to see what's going on in the mind of someone who's good at this, has done a lot of this, then you can ask questions and you also learn through that process. So this is just one deal and one perspective, but Chris has done other deals and will do other deals. And you know what I mean? So yeah, thank you so much for really
going that was fun. That. Yes, terrific questions. And I'm glad we could go through that because we certainly couldn't have done all the other presentation as well as that. In addition. And again, if you're listening to that, you know, either later on, you can reach out. My information is chris@nextlevelincome.com. We can set up a time on the website, nextlevelincome.com. You can get a hold of me. I can go through any of this. And if you want to see our deals that come through, you can click on the invest link and put your information in there.
Perfect. And there's a bunch of free gifts at nextlevelincome.com/bliss. So you can get his book and really get to know Chris even deeper and sort of the way that he thinks about this. Like we got a ton today, but
I got plenty more. Yeah. We got all kinds of free books up there. Got our awesome podcast with you, Monica, that was on there. Yeah. And we keep trying to put more and more resources up there to help people out because our goal is really the first two tenets of Next Level Income are make money, keep money, and then grow your money. We talked about how to grow your money in an investment today, but it's a great time of the year right now coming into December to figure out how to keep more of your money through tax strategies and those sorts of things. We have a ton of stuff as well that can help out with that.
Nice. So yeah. So ladies, you can go to nextlevelincome.com/bliss to get that book and get more of those freebies that Chris so generously shared with us. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Monica.
Yay. Tracy, so I'm going to assume you don't have any other questions. Thank you for joining us. And everybody who's listening later or was here today, just always remember, goals without action are just dreams. So get out there, take action, and create the life your heart deeply desires. We'll see you soon. Bye. Wasn't that an amazing webinar? Chris really does a great job, doesn't he? So don't forget to join Chris and me this Thursday for our live webinar on how to evaluate a syndication. I'm so excited to share this with you this Thursday from 1 to 2:30 p.m. Pacific time. Bring all of your questions and don't miss it. To sign up, go to blissfulinvestor.com/syndication webinar. That's blissfulinvestor.com/syndication webinar. See you then.
I hope you enjoyed today's show. If you'd like to find out more about how to become a blissful millionaire, go to blissfulinvestor.com. See you next time.